Are you tired of working with generic IT providers that rely on you to be the expert? Arc IT goes beyond just fixing your tech headaches. They specialize in proactive IT management, BIM support, and data security for architecture firms. The team at Arc IT gets your tech so you can focus on doing your best work. Whether you're a small firm of 10 or a growing practice with 50 or more employees, unleash the full potential of your creative vision with Arc IT. Visit getarcit.com and schedule your free IT assessment today. This episode of Spaces Podcast is supported by Sitio Landscape Architecture and NCARP. You'll hear more about them later on in the show.
There's all these decisions that have already been made. That, like, technology, there's a famous line, like, technology is a series of decisions that have already been made. Like, you've got your Mac. That's because the Mac's designed, right? You have to deal with it. You can go and try and build a whole new company, but it's too hard. So how do we as people who naturally know how to make decisions and create our environments together do that in the face of these massive technical systems that we have built? These bureaucracies and the standards and the supply chains and the contracts, like, it's really hard. And it's sad because the output is generally a lower quality of built environment.
This is Spaces Podcast, where we aim to elevate the appreciation and understanding of the spaces we occupy every day. Hello, my name is Demetrius. Thank you for coming back. In this episode, we're going to talk about co-design, discussing the belief that cities' digital transformations should be built on a foundation of ensuring that ideas are rooted in the interests of the people that live there. In this conversation, we define what co-design is, get a bit philosophical, and explore technology that may facilitate the process of aggregating the ideas of community members. I'm joined by Michelle as we have a fascinating conversation with Rob Asher, CEO of Giraffe, an early stage real estate development platform that accelerates finding, assessing, and developing sites. Supported by real-time data from designs and detailed customization opportunities, Giraffe empowers users with connectivity to quickly scale developments with confidence. So, Michelle, we're talking today about something called co-design. Have you ever heard of co-design?
I can't say that I have.
Okay. So, it's sort of a high-level, rough definition of co-design. It's basically the idea of community members being treated as equal collaborators and contributing to the design process. But we do have someone who's involved in sort of shepherding the concept of co-design through their particular avenue. He is the CEO of Giraffe. Please help me welcome Rob Asher. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be on.
Yeah. So I'm excited to dig into this. This is actually going to dovetail nicely into a previous conversation that we had. A portion of it, they talked about a project that was being developed, and they talked about how they actually did crowdfunding of local community members and to bring them into the project and have sort of a stake in the development of this project. It's not to the level of contributing design input per se, but they did have some leverage because they were essential stakeholders in this project. So I think this will kind of dovetailed nicely into what we're going to talk about today. But before we jump fully into it, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and anything that I may have missed as far as Giraffe goes?
Yeah, I think the key thing to know about Giraffe from me is that I was a practicing architect for 5 or 6 years. And I was mainly working at early stage feasibility and competition. So design excellence competitions are, I'm here in Sydney in Australia, and one of the mechanisms with which policymakers drive excellent design is they give developers a floor space bonus if they conduct an independent design excellence competition. So it means you're competing, you know, three architecture firms head to head, an independent jury of assessors that are, you know, luminary architects, you know, town planners, etc., and they select the best design on its merits, and then the developer can go and build it, which is a great training ground to, you know, see that intersection between policy and commerce and design in an extremely high you know, pressure cooker environment. So that's my and basically what Giraffe came out of was doing that a lot and looking at the processes that everyone always does, the technological processes, and then building a product that I wished I had as that design architect. And, you know, to the topic at hand, I see architecture really, and I know this, you know, just to preface this, architecture in Australia and the UK and the US, they're the same profession. They've got slightly different flavors and different emphases. So this is obviously colored from my Southern Hemisphere Australian view. Architecture is inherently co-design ish in the sense you are always mediating between engineers, policymakers, clients, tenants, owners, capital partners, and you're trying to find a solution that every single stakeholder can understand and appreciate the reason you got to where it was, and understand that although they may have made some compromises and may not be exactly what they want, they feel like they've been heard and their needs have been responded to. So it's quite natural then to go the next step and say, this development, right, it's going to be a big tower, say 60 stories in this city. It's going to affect everyone for like 200 years. It's going to shadow the parks. And so how do we get their voices in, you know, subject to the constraint? So I think co-design is not new in a way, right? It's very close to what architects do already as stakeholder managers. So Giraffe is built to facilitate those kind of conversations.
For much of human history, people have lived in small-scale groups, working together on a common course of action to achieve collective goals. If the group found it impossible to agree, it would disband to form new groups or remove uncooperative individuals. While easy in small groups, coming to a consensus became increasingly difficult as populations grew. The only way to agree on a common course of action was to create a network of decision-making, a hierarchical system, but not a social hierarchy. In this system, a coordinator at the center of the network can easily collaborate and enact decisions with a group of 10 or so. Those 10 individuals can then do the same with 10 more individuals each, and so on, gathering the wishes of the larger group to obtain consensus or a common course of action. During the Holocene era, almost 12,000 years ago, rapid proliferation and growth of the human species worldwide brought about increased conflict as misaligned human societies came into frequent contact and disagreement with each other. Hierarchical societies appeared, spread, and then evolved into larger scale societies. These societies evolved to become extremely unequal and ultimately corroded society-wide cooperation. This social hierarchy structure was then established based on local administrative control and the distribution of land. A landowner distributed land with the promise of military and legal protection in return for a payment of some kind from the person who received it. This hierarchical social structure was also reflected in the development of our cities. In the early 20th century, urban planning had more to do with top-down visions, but a pioneering town planner, Patrick Geddes, advocated that planning considered the needs and ideas of local people. In the following years, this belief would grow and evolve. In the 1930s, the field of public opinion formalized as an academic and professional discipline, and public opinion polls became more common as companies and governments began to understand the value of listening to people. This was expanded in a remarkable way in the early 1940s when planners in London began to think about post-war reconstruction. They viewed this moment as an opportunity to engage the public and use town planning as a tool for recovery and improving lives. Groups of social science researchers were hired by the government to survey the public with questions like, "Do you know what town planning is? What do you think should be done about post-war housing? Do you think it is necessary to be near schools, bus routes, big shops, stations?" Unfortunately, execution on the feedback fell flat, as actual influence remained limited by the hierarchical structure. This inaction discouraged the public, and active efforts to listen and engage them declined. But by the 1960s, the general public in Europe and the US had grown critical on several fronts. Following periods of poor living conditions, labor and wage disputes, inequality, and civil rights abuses, to name a few, the public began to demand that their voices be heard, and public participation was renewed. The enthusiasm spread widely, encouraging new approaches to effectively learn and act on the will of the people. A formal approach known as cooperative design, or also referred to as co-design or participatory design, originated in Scandinavia in the 1970s and 80s as a commitment to democratically empower workers and foster democracy in the workplace. It aimed to form partnerships with labor unions that would allow workers to determine the shape and scope of new technologies introduced into the workplace, rather than being forced to accept new systems, particularly those that put people out of work. There were three main criteria for the approach. 1. Quality of life for workers. It was meant to improve workers' quality of life, both in terms of control over their own work organization, tools, and processes, and their ability to perform their given task with ease. 2. Collaborative development. Researchers and designers were to find mechanisms to ensure that data collection and analysis would be done in conjunction with participants, not just on their behalf. 3. Iterative process. Informal knowledge and practices are by their nature difficult to see and understand, as each change in a prototype tends to unearth other tacit practices and knowledge. It is important to have a series of opportunities to sustain continuous worker engagement throughout the process of design and research. In opposition to the concept, some see limitations in this methodology. Since co-design aims to gain consensus of the group, some argue that it does not lend itself to the radical change or innovation that emerges from a singular or streamlined decision-making process. In fact, co-design designers have been cautioned to think of their work as evolution, not revolution. Another perceived limitation is that some strains of the approach tend to focus too narrowly, assuming that focusing on a specific issue will result in empowering changes to the overall. Lastly, co-design research takes an enormous amount of time, resources, and institutional commitment to pull off. Despite these opposing views, there has been a noticeable shift in thinking in society, potentially accelerated by the perceived effectiveness of tech industry culture. Society is increasingly becoming more open source, more in line with a co-design approach, and pushing for more people to have a seat at the table. Notable evidence is represented in recent movements and support for representation. In published research, quantifying how diverse leadership results in better decision-making and higher returns for companies. Varied opinions and experiences prove to provide the breadth of knowledge required to make the best decisions for a group. While we still find the built environment molded by the few, the public's voice is increasingly being heard as more and more tools make organizing easier. These advancements in technology are democratizing all facets of our life. It appears that it may also unlock the building industry, to reestablish society-wide cooperation for the betterment of our communities. Now, before we get back to our conversation, we're going to share a little bit more about our sponsors. All right, for our California listeners, this is for you. CTO Landscape Architecture in Anaheim, California is a young, ambitious, fast-growing firm providing landscape architecture planning and design services to the AEC industry, real estate developers, and public agencies alike. CTO's expertise with designing California native landscapes and water efficiency calculations makes permitting a smooth, painless process. The CTO team is continuously revising and improving workflows to better meet project milestones while providing the flexibility to work within client schedules. Their work from anywhere, anytime office schedule allows for agility when it comes to delivering client work and balancing personal time and life events. Learn more at ctola.com. That's S-I-T-I-O-L-A.com. Or you can call or text to 657-217-6169 to see how CTO can help with your latest development project. Now, I touched on a few stakeholders that CTO helps, but to further that point, they don't rely on a single project type or limit their focus. They work on diverse project types, including infill developments, multifamily affordable housing, public works, private residential and commercial properties, healthcare, and outdoor entertainment spaces. Whatever your project is, I'm sure if you reach out to CTO, they can jump in to help. Have you heard of NCARB? It's the National Council of Architectural Registration Boards, and they want to hear from you. Yes, you. NCARB's Analysis of Practice study is your opportunity to shape the future of architecture. Participate in this industry-wide survey to share your experiences and insights from working in the AEC industry. Your feedback will help guide changes to what being a licensed architect looks like and impact how architects collaborate with other professionals in the future. Again, whether you're an architect or work with architects, NCARB wants to hear from you. So make sure your voice is heard. Contribute to the Analysis of Practice study today. Sign up at ncarb.org/AOP. That's ncarb.org/AOP. And now let's get back to the conversation. So how is Giraffe approaching this problem?
You know the story that Peter Drucker tells about the train industry, and they thought they were in trains, but they were actually in transportation. And as soon as aeroplanes came out, people had no attachment to trains. They just wanted to get from Washington to New York. And if an aeroplane got them there in half the time, I'll never sit in a train again. I'll just go straight to an aeroplane. Yeah. So actually understanding what you do is quite difficult. And I think this is the same for designers and even developers. And I think there's a sort of a schizophrenic nature to the architect, right? There's the artist, as in the visionary, you know, and this is like the Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, Starchitect kind of like lone genius, like, you know, the Howard Roark, I don't know, the Ayn Rand kind of, you know, that guy. I haven't ever read it, but the guy that sets up the business, you know, the gulch, whatever gulch he goes to, that guy. And then there's the bus driver where it's like, hey, architect, I don't care what you think. I need you to plan a building that looks kind of like this, but I'm not going to learn how to use Revit. You use Revit and just give me what I want. You can choose the carpet color, whatever you need, but you're a functionary you're like a sort of a servant, and I think architects actually provide both those services together because the tooling is so complicated, like to open Revit or to build a BIM model or to understand how to get a permit. It's often mind-numbingly boring, but it's very difficult. So hold those two things in your heads. What Giraffe is trying to do is that technical bit. So calculating the numbers, FAR, yields, the mechanical bits of architecture, the technical bits. We basically want to fully automate so that we're turning developers, and we have developer clients, right, who've never created a BIM model in their life. They can draw in Giraffe and they get a BIM model, but it's a trick. You know, they don't think, we don't say, hey, you'll build a BIM model. That would scare them, right? They'd say, oh, I've got my architect to do that. But they just do some sketching in Giraffe and it turns into a BIM model with all the benefits, like area takeoffs and all the stuff that BIM's great at, because we're automating it really elegantly, right? So if we can automate that technical barrier, the thesis is, or the idea is, that participants who are kept out of design just by this technical gap, not because they lack imagination, not because they lack clarity on what they want, not because they lack vision, you know, just because they don't know how to describe it in SketchUp or Revit, and so, you know, they locked out. We automate that, we lower that gate, and then they can jump in, because I think the technical stuff will never go away. You will never get a building approved unless you know it's FAR and you know its impact on flood and its power. It just can't. Like, we're in a modern society. You can't be building mud huts by hand, and it just won't. So you need the technical. But if you automate it, let's lower the barrier to entry, simplify it, and come in. And then the tension for us is, like, when do you oversimplify it? When does it turn from something like powerful, like Adobe Illustrator, to something like clip art, where you can, like, remember those, you know what I mean? Where it's a fake empowerment. It's just, you can choose a bunch of templates. So we're trying to make it simple, but expressive for non-experts.
Yeah. Is this through a browser?
Yeah, it's all, so it's a piece of browser-based SaaS. My vision is it feels like a computer game, almost like SimCity, where it's so approachable that people start understanding the systems. And rather than it's a game mechanism where you make points and, I don't know, you know, SimCity style, it's real life mechanisms around funding structures, but it's gamified in the sense it's simplified and approachable so that people can sort of understand trade-offs. Because a lot of what co-design is trade-offs. You have five people in a room. Mm-hmm. They're not going to agree. There's no way. And so you're going to have to fight, and there's going to be winners and losers. And luckily, there's not one big winner and one big loser, but everyone will win and lose on certain things and have to make trade-offs. And that's key. And so then that's the second thing Giraffe does, is because it's so easy, you work live. So you work in real time. So it's not like, hey, let's do a scheme for this park. And then someone says, oh, we should put a community center here. And then someone says, oh, well, that's going to block my light. And then the architect goes, okay, I'll do two studies and I'll come back to you, right, next week. And I'll bring the sun studies. And then the next week, here's option one. And then someone goes, oh, well, can we, here's sub-option 2A. And anyone who's ever worked in design will know, at 3 weeks into the process, you've got like 55 options. Everyone's confused. You're trying to, and it's so slow that the conversation, even if it's trying to be participatory, is not, because people have forgotten what they said last week. You know, the minutes for the meeting were not perfectly, you know, and so, so what Giraffe does is you can stretch and pull in real time and say, okay, well, let's add a story. Boom. And then it does the solar analysis. So do you, you look, you've just, you've got your extra story. So your return on cost looks better, but you've obliterated sunlight to the park, which means the grass won't grow. Which means, you know, and then you have an evidence-based discussion. So that technical stuff is happening, but a conversation is also happening. And so that's the utopia we're trying to build. Does it make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. And it's actually, as you were talking, my heart started beating fast because I was getting nervous. Because I'm thinking about, you know, that much power is almost dangerous in when you're trying to work through design process, because you almost end up opening the Pandora's box to infinite options and infinite opinions because you can move so quickly. Mm. But at the same time, it is very powerful because you can speak to specific data and specific information. Because when we're in a meeting, you know, talking through sketches, it's the same thing, but now you have something to back it up.
Correct.
With.
You have the data there. So your finance person can be like, well, that's not going to work. You've just, you know what I mean? It's like the sketch tells you something. That's exactly right. Okay. So I'm certainly I don't know who the relevant comic book hero is, but I like the chaos. Like, let's take the risk. Let's empower the people and see where we go. I certainly want that. Of course, a lot of our users use Giraffe in a very tightly controlled way. So they use that power. And which I also think is totally valid, right? You know, I'm not running a city, and I understand that developers with large, you know, if you've got a lot of capital at risk, your risk profile is much lower. And so you're trying to, that's fine. But what we have noticed, right? And we've actually got a guy who's doing a PhD on this using Giraffe, where he's testing this live design process with groups and then an old traditional, like butter paper, like yellow trace and pens. And he hasn't published his PhD yet. I can't wait for it. He won't send it to me till it's published. But he says it's noticeable, the difference. And what you actually get is convergence. Because you test like three options in 2 minutes, you stretch it, you add a level. He says, no, that you explore the design space really quickly. And it's not, it's the opposite of that thing where, well, you know, where some people in the room is like, I know that I'm uncomfortable with this, but I don't know why. So I'm just going to ask for another four options to be done just to hedge myself. Because they see it all, they go, actually, you know what? I'm actually comfortable with this. And so I think human beings in conversation have an ability to achieve groupthink, right? Like good or bad, right? You can achieve a consensus. So we've actually seen it, and the study will come out, and I'll send it to you, and I'll sing it from the rooftops, that it actually, it increases rigor, increases engagement, but it reduces time. And it's not that, I can tell you've done, you're an architect, right? You've done options. You've had that thing where you've left a meeting with like, now I have to do 65 options. Like, how am I going to do this? Right. It doesn't actually lead to that. It actually leads to the opposite, which is awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
As you've been talking and I've been kind of clicking around the website, I am trying to understand how, as a developer and more specifically as a home builder, you know, how we would best utilize this, or is it really a tool that is better equipped for the architect and or the land planner to be using as a means to avoid those 65 options, right? Because from where I sit and backing up way to my college days, my whole life I thought or my whole childhood and teen years and leading up to college, I wanted to be an architect. And it was when I got to university and was actually in architecture school that I said, wait a minute, it's a developer that dictates what the architect is doing. Like, unless you really make it, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's the developer and the principal, the sponsor that's, you know, giving direction to the architect on what to plan, and here's the density to solve for, and here's what you can and can't do. And then, you know, the architect sort of, like you said earlier, Rob, taking orders. And that in large part was why I switched majors to business and ultimately became a developer. So as to Giraffe, I guess I'm just curious about, you know, applicability that you've seen, maybe kind of the history of the company. How long have you been in business, and who do you actually see using the
software?
The software. I mean, are you finding that it's primarily architects, or, you know, how many developers, builders, principals, sponsors, capital partners are kind of getting familiar with it? And I'll just add, you know, one of the things that I think is always tough is when you introduce technology, there's that learning curve, right?
Totally.
And how do you get people up to speed on how to actually get the most out of the software?
Yeah, those are like the questions on our mission, right? That's the extent to which we're successful in getting people who are not architects to use the software is the extent to which the software becomes a co-design tool, because you suddenly actually got true co-design. It's not just an architect driving something and you've actually got multiple people in. And that's constant pressure for us to make it easier, more like a game, more simple without sacrificing power. We're doing well on that. I'm super proud of what our team has done. We've been in the market for about 2 years. We have got hundreds of developers in there. So generally, it's developers that have a background. Either they studied architecture, or they were an architect, or they were an engineer. So they're not scared of drawing a polyline. Like, they used CAD like 10 years ago. So they've got like a little step into it. You know, because there's another kind of developer which is just on the phone and the business cards, and they're a pure commercial entity. That sort of developer, we just go to their architect. But a developer that's got a little bit of history, just a tiny bit, is normally onboarded in Giraffe, and they're dangerous in about 20 minutes. Do you know what I mean? They get it. They go, I draw this, and then I add, and oh, that's my pro forma done. Oh, wow, that's quicker than phoning the architect. And now when I speak to them, I'm just showing them kind of what I want. So the conversation goes from a 40-minute briefing session where we're sort of saying, oh, what if, yeah, just down to like a 3-minute, here it is, right? So we are in use by developers. Another big customer base of ours is state agencies, right? So people deploying capital. So say this is like schools, boards, or hospitals, bridges, you know, any kind of infrastructure. And they generally, they think like a developer, as in they deploy capital to build stuff. but they're not turning a pool of capital into a bigger pool of capital. They're generally, they've got an allocation of funding and they've got to demonstrate some kind of, you know, increased quality of life or climate resilience or transportation time or educational outcome, right? So they're looking for a return from that capital, but it's a more complicated way of measuring it. Does that make sense? So there we've also got a lot of users that are using Giraffe to plan out precincts and schools and hospitals and infrastructure. So that government side as well, which is cool.
So you mentioned a few examples of the schools and other locations. Do you have any projects that you've kind of seen identified as co-design and maybe Giraffe sort of was a tool to do so?
Yeah, I'll talk to one in particular, which was a railway corridor. And this was when I was working as an architect at Cox Architecture, which is a big firm here in Australia. And one of the things that that Cox did and Giraffe was involved in was, so this is this huge corridor, it's a new train line. And so you can imagine it's cutting through multiple jurisdictions and it's, mm-hmm. and the land ownership is very complicated. And those different jurisdictions, so say your federal, your state, your city, they've each got different capital allocation programs. The private landowners are trying to consolidate lands across this. There's needs in terms of infrastructure provision, water, all these kind of things. So it's more of an urban, it was a strategic plan. But the way that they, that we ended up doing it was we got everyone into a huge room. So invited like hundreds of people across this corridor from every walk of life. Now, this wasn't true co-design in the sense that these weren't community members. We couldn't go to the point where these are just people. Like, well, in Australia, we call them punters. I guess you call them Joe citizens or, you know, just man on the street, right?
Yeah.
There were still, they were generally representing people. So, you know, representatives from water, from transport, from the local governments, from the borough, you know, all of that stuff. And what we did is we divided it up, and then in Giraffe, they sat around a table and they drew options, and it was incredible. It was actually incredible, because what actually ended up happening is we thought that was the plan. So we were like, let's just get them to design this corridor, and then you'll get this local knowledge, and you'll short-circuit a whole bunch of engagement because everyone will have been there and will have seen it, so you won't have to do 25 briefings and set up coffee carts and all this sort of stuff. They didn't manage even to get to the design bit, because what it turned out was that everyone had so much information in their heads that we couldn't have accessed otherwise. It basically, we just gathered information for like, and we had done a huge amount of preparatory work. And this is the key thing with co-design, is that if you're co-designing, the architect or the leader becomes a facilitator. And you know that a facilitator, like you guys are great facilitators, like a podcast, you know more about me, more than me, where this conversation's going. You're listening to me, but you're already two steps ahead and anticipating and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. The facilitator of a co-design workshop needs to be that sophisticated, where they're drawing stuff out, but also steering the ship. It's not just like all right, guys, what should we do? You know,
yeah.
It's got to be like, we've got to think about these issues. And if someone's getting too dominant, you've got to quiet them down or ask them to, you know, if someone's too fearful, bring them forward. So it's quite a complicated job, right?
Yeah.
So we had done this huge amount of preparatory work to do that job here. And we'd looked at the GIS layers and we'd researched and we'd put them on a Giraffe and we'd map them out. And we thought we knew everything about this corridor, but oh, holy heck, we did not, right? There's like, oh no, we've just signed a deal with these guys to turn that car park into a bus station, and oh, it hasn't been released, but so we just mapped that stuff. So as they spoke, like we were furiously on Giraffe, like just building this map, right? Mm. So Giraffe, you think of it, it's just a map of the world. It's a digital twin of the whole world. So we were putting all this information, tracing this stuff, saying who it came from, what status it was. And by the end, you had this really thick, really, really thick, dense understanding of this corridor that we otherwise would not have achieved. But yeah. What it says to us is only then were we ready to do the code. Actually, now let's make some decisions, right? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, you guys have done, you architects and developers, you've done context analysis and site analysis. You know how hard it can be to find information. But I think just doing it through this kind of interview, it's almost like a startup style where you do user interviews. It's like it's very conversational. It was jaw-dropping to me how much information in the world goes around in individuals' heads And if you don't speak to them and get them in a place where they can share it in a structured way, it only comes out 3 years later. You know what I mean? And the project's 6 years, 6 months behind. And you know, and someone's like, I could have told you that. Yeah. I don't know if you, have you guys heard of the All Bugs Are Shallow? It's a software thing. So it's all bugs are shallow to someone. So bug is a, you know, bugs are errors in the code. And some of them are absolute nightmares to solve. You can't figure it out. But the saying is all bugs are shallow to someone. Like to, there's someone on earth who will look at this problem and get it in 10 seconds. Like they've seen this, you know what I mean? And so if you can surf this, which is why open source is, like you put your code out and say, I've got this problem. Someone will see it and solve your problem. And I think co-design, there's definitely an element of that factor. Like you want to capture as many viewpoints as you can, because the information in that person to you, the developer, or the person who's trying to push this thing through, it's magic.
I think you preemptively answered my question that I had next, but maybe you have a different answer. What is the vision, or what do you think, what kind of world does the co-design open up?
Okay, this is where I'll get philosophical here. Okay, so I think one of the biggest challenges facing humankind, right at the top, okay, is we're more and more living in an artificial world. Okay, so it's not, you go to those old, how do I sort of frame this? Go to like an old European city that was built by hand, say Santorini in Greece, even Paris, those Italian towns, which people love, and they are so beautiful and organic and sophisticated, carbon negative to the, you know, how did those cities come? They weren't designed. They were inherently co-designed because people just did them together, right? And I've been renovating my house, and I needed to build a pergola. I built the pergola. It looks beautiful. I didn't do a single drawing. You're just there. And as you work, you get feedback, you ask people, and so it just happens. So it's very natural for people to design together, right? Fast forward to, say, sort of what, you know, us, right? Our modern industrial culture. The impact that an individual can have on something is like, are you going to remove gypsum board or particle OSB from the supply chain? No, right? And all the carpenters, they need to use it. So you will have to use particle board, right? If you're going to build something economically, like that decision is made. You can't mess with it. And so there's all these decisions that have already been made. That, like technology, there's a famous like line, like technology is a series of decisions that have already been made. Like you've got your Mac. That's because the Mac's designed, right? You have to deal with it. You can go and try and build a whole new company, but it's too hard. Yeah. So how do we as people who naturally know how to make decisions and create our environments together do that in the face of these massive technical systems that we have built? You know, like your Department of Infrastructure or your DOT or your federal, these bureaucracies and the standards and the supply chains and the contracts, like, it's really hard. And it's sad because the output is generally a lower quality of built environment. As in, if you walk around the average town built today, people are not going to just travel to it just because it's so beautiful in the way that they just travel to Santorini just to look at it because it's so stunning. Mm-hmm. And we could do Santorini. It's so cheap and easy. They built it out of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's like how, you know, the approval, it just doesn't. So I see that problem of helping, empowering people to engage with these extremely complex forces, technological forces, in a way that the technological force doesn't just overwhelm them and they get the same, you know, it's just cookie cutter. It's like, dude, we do 5-on-1s or whatever you guys call them. I always try to use your US. We do 5-on-1s. You get 5-on-1s. That's it. Yeah. Like, no, like you can, it can either be like this or that, but it's a, right? How do you actually empower them to make a difference, right? Or to at least have a decision. Okay. And so the paradox of us is we're using technology to help empower them almost against technology, but trying to do it. So where I want it to go, where I'd love it to go, is that people with systems like Giraffe, like humane technology, are able to be able to navigate the things that you normally pay an architect to navigate because they're so complicated more and more naturally and more immediately. And so they will have the feeling that they can make decisions and build forms and neighborhoods, and they understand the technology rather than the other way around, where it feels like the neighborhood is just like, oh, someone's putting a freeway overpass there. I didn't know that. Like, I guess, right? They funded it. And so then it's this feeling that things just happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really ugly, I think that's a really ugly thing. I think that's really bad for people's humanity. I think it makes them feel depressed, you know what I mean? And disempowered. So that would, and the worst thing to me is that these systems and these cadence that we're in right now, where you just deploy capital as fast as possible, and that continues, and sort of people become more and more alienated from their environment. I think that's sort of that's the bad, and then the fully empowered is the good. I think, I don't know, I'm an optimist, but
so. I appreciated the philosophical direction that you went there, Rob. maybe along the same lines, who is co-design for?
From my perspective, co-design is for the people who are going to use the thing, right? And this is why I think Santorini is so beautiful, because the people who are going to be in Santorini built Santorini. Like, they wanted a house, you build the house. And I'm building my house now. I love green, so I just paint, like, you can see my walls green, right? I just painted it green. And you may hate green, but this is, you know, it's for me. So it means that the feedback loop is perfect, right? Whereas currently design is generally the people doing it and the people who use it. You can do market research. You can try and figure out what people want, but it's decoupled, right? Because of your freeway engineers who are building the freeways. It's so technical and so complicated what they're doing, and they're doing soil samples and traffic studies and machine learning, and they can't, you know, so these guys that are just living in the neighborhood, one day they'll get an announcement saying, hey, we're putting a freeway in, like, now's your chance to complain. You have 38 hours or whatever. And then they can be like, I hate it or whatever, right? But it's the people that are going to live next to it don't really have a vehicle into the design process. So it's separated. So I think what I would say that my definition of co-design is the users and the designers become the same, because then that's a great thing. Then they can't complain about what they get because they made it, but it means that they're incentivized to make it beautiful. I'd love to know how the developer thinks responds to that.
Yeah. Well, because what I'm struggling to understand. So in concept, I totally get it. But I'm struggling to understand how the capital that may be funding the project, how do you get the input of all of the users or some of the users if they aren't monetarily tied to the project in the same way that the capital that's providing to the project is?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that has to come down to kind of how our previous conversation was, Michelle, where there almost has to be this policy requirement that there has to be funding from community members to some level, whatever that number may be, and that gives them that stake.
I really like, so that crowdfunding.
Could you imagine that working in the United States? People are so selfish. Are you kidding? Yeah. Like,
I reckon this is a true. So it's a pessimistic.
I feel like this works in. I think, Rob, you said something about Scandinavia. I think you said something about Scandinavia.
Yeah, yeah.
I get it. You know, I studied abroad in Denmark, and shoot, the Danes are. They'd be all over this. They'd be like, heck yeah,
no,
you
know, they are.
You want to? Yeah. We need to contribute 10% of our income. Sure, like, you know, and that's why you go to places like Copenhagen, and it's stunning and operates well, and it's, you know, there's all these, you go to their public transit and it works on a dime and it's on time and it's clean, and, you know, but
not in the
USA. I'm just trying to understand the applicability.
I hear you, right? So the do you know the Baugruppen model? Are you guys across that? It's a European model where basically the equity partners of a development are the buyers, and it's a way of basically setting up a temporary developer where you pre-sell the development, but then they also equity fund it. So you're kind of short-circuiting that thing. That's big in Europe. Big in Europe. Don't know if it'll work in the US. I think crowdfunding in the US is quite interesting in terms of, like, Kickstarter, and there's a bunch of models which short-circuit that capital consumer circle. So I think there are models. I'm certainly an optimist on human nature. I think people are actually very generous, and I think often what looks like selfishness is fear, because either they don't understand the system or they feel a bit abused by the system, which is sort of a thread of what I've been saying.
Yeah, I agree.
But on the other side, I am a capitalist in the sense that it takes initiative and energy to make anything happen, right? And so if you say, oh, we'll just let the community like crowdfund themselves, that's not going to happen. Like you need someone who's driving, and generally they're driving for a financial incentive, not always, but I think there is a tension between, so for me, co-design, like I kind of alluded to, there's always a facilitator. There's always an energy pushing it along, trying to get from A to B, and they're trying to bring in as many people as possible and viewpoints. But there is that energy. And Michelle, I can hear you say you kind of dropped out of architecture into development because you like the push, and you want to be the originator and the momentum. Yeah. So co-design, I like that. I like people that have energy and they have a vision and they want to make it happen. So I don't want to get rid of that. I don't want to go full, like communism collective or whatever. But
So question about Giraffe. I was just looking, and not to get too far off topic, but I think it ties into a lot of what we're talking about with just kind of the philosophical approach of co-design and having that user be involved. So I was just looking at the pricing for Giraffe. Rob, I don't know who your competitors are, if you have competitors, but when you know, is this project or is this company Giraffe and kind of the impetus behind it, was it really born from more of the philosophical ideas that you've talked about where this needs to be the future, this co-design, this users being involved in building and creating the environment and the money component to Giraffe is a so what? Or is Giraffe like here because you see that this platform is going to financially send you into, you know, some...
I'm going to be the new Zuckerberg. That's right. No, yeah. Look, that's a great question. That's a pointed personal question.
That's why I'm on this. That's why I'm a co-host here.
Yeah. Someone's got to ask it. The key. So my dad was a professor. I sort of Giraffe. A lot of it came out of research I was teaching at university, and I chose architecture, right? Which, as you know, is not the best paid. It's certainly, I don't know, maybe architects make bank in the States, not here. So.
No, they don't. No.
So I've never, been financially driven. That being said, I'm not commercially, you know, we are commercially astute. For me, and I represent, I've got a company here I've got to provide for my family. So it's kind of like what I'm saying about co-design. We need to make money. And we will make money. And the amount of value that we're unlocking with Giraffe is crazy. Like we are taking for our clients, like a process that would take them 200 hours with their architect to get from sort of A to a master plan, like where they can sign off on a pursuit. That's coming down to less than 40 hours of internal time. So it's like an 80% reduction in their consulting spend and time. We're automating their pro formas. So like we're just creating exorbitant value for our clients, and we're aware of that, and we're charging them for that because we're making money, and I hope that we make good money. And the reason I hope that we make good money is because I am not a theoretician. So I could have gone and, you know, if I'd followed, you know, my father's footsteps and like sort of the way I was raised, I would be in academia and I'd be researching co-design and I'd love supporting that. But I want to see a change. I want to see a change in the way that capital is deployed in cities. And I want it to be more holistic, and I want it to be more sustainable, creating better health. I want it to be beautiful. Like, because the planet is now almost fully urbanized, and it's just, you know, the cities are the thing that we're building that is either going to set us free as a species or like destroy the planet. We'll just extract all the resources, turn it into this big, ugly parking lot, and it'll just, you know, blow up. And I don't want to see that happen. So I am highly motivated by a more sophisticated capital allocation process. Or another way of saying it, a more holistic, democratic or co-design design process, which connects the needs of people with, you know, with that capital allocation. And so I'm super interested in crowdfunding and equity models and the way that the money drives the incentives that drives the systems. I'm also interested in the way that design can happen in real time and bring in different viewpoints. But I'm a very pragmatist. Like I want to see, you know, if Giraffe's good, and I think it is good, I want to see it used in every single capital allocation decision, if it's going to make that capital decision better, right? then we'll make a living. Like I'm, you know, everyone on this call, we're all speaking like through undersea cables. Like we're all fine. We've got food. We're not, you know, we'll be fine. We will make money. I don't think you'll see me next to Elon Musk and the guys, but, but what I, if I would die happy if giraffe was used, you know, it's more of an ego thing, I guess, if you look at it that way than a money thing.
Is giraffe pulling from Google data, like Google Street Maps data,
so cool, right? So we pull from any public data set. So like, okay. if there's a county that has an Esri, like an ArcGIS server, or if you've got ReGrid data, or if you've got any data source that you have, we just plug into and we just pull. So we've got like hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of layers. So like anything, and we're in the US, we're in Israel, we're in Japan, we're in Australia, and we're basically my vision. Ultimate co-design is giraffe is a digital twin of the world where you can see everyone's designs right in real time. So I would like fly to, where are you guys? What city are you in?
We're in Irvine, California.
Irvine, California. So you would fly to Irvine and you would see this 3D model of what people are doing, what capital's been hit, what people would love to see happening, what the students are, you know, and you would be able to like navigate through this. I guess it's a freaking metaverse now. I should start calling it. But navigate through this model that's powered by real data, real analytics, real systems, and then be able to say, look, this, I like this or I don't like this. And so one of our product lines we call Places, which is where you do your 3D modeling and your feasibility and your engineering and you get your business case, like you underwrite the deal, you get your performer singing. But then you push that 3D model to the public and say, what do you guys, like, look at it, tell us. In a way that trusts them rather than the pretty render where they get like a tiny little video and they have to trust that you haven't, you know, photoshopped a tree in front of the building and the, you know what I mean? So they can spin around, they can change the sun, see if it shadows them, they can do all of this stuff. So I think that kind of, if we could make it so inclusive so that people could understand what's happening in their cities, right, from the various tiers like the BlackRocks and the mega $1 trillion of capital and then the federal agencies and the state agencies and the local community groups and the activists and the developers, and they could see everyone's picture, everyone's wants, that would be awesome. And we haven't figured out how to do that, but that's what we're trying to get to.
Yeah. So to that point, Michelle brought up the pricing but didn't mention the actual price. One, can you mention the price? And then two, do you foresee at some point you guys being able to create some sort of public version that anybody can jump on there with, whether it's a limited number of hours or a smaller threshold, pricing threshold or something like that?
So the way we priced is $3,000 per user per year, okay. Which is much cheaper than our competitors, but you get a free project for life, as you know, and you get three viewers. So in Giraffe, you create a project, you can invite people in. So you can, it's very similar to stuff like Figma, where there's like this, you get this free stuff, and maybe we'll up that to a couple free projects or something. We're generally pretty nice. If you ask, you know, especially if you are, my revenue guy hates me because I always say yes to whatever anyone says. But, you know, you can always, so that's how our pricing. So we're
is that 3,000 Australian?
No, US dollars.
Oh, US. Okay.
Yeah. So we're in the US and we sell in, yeah. So we sell in US dollars. It's more well known than the Australian dollar around the world. Mm-hmm. So, so that's the pricing answer. We are in the next, I think, couple of months, you'll start seeing some really cool giraffe assets in various media outlets in America. Mm-hmm. And you'll start to be looking at these kind of models of what's coming and the kind of information that's going to inform and empower the people, right? And now the most interested people, which will be developers and kind of activists and NIMBYs and YIMBYs and sort of the people that are activated about the city will obviously get in there first. And then people that are like, I don't care about this. But hopefully we'll be informed. So we'll sort of diffuse the knowledge through, but it's something we're going to iterate on and something you should see more of soon. Yeah.
So, 'cause I love this idea of, like, you know, just the random person at home that has heard about a development nearby and they start to noodle on what they think should be there and then push it out and say, look, how about this? And people can, whoever's driving the bus on this can say, you know what, that part of it makes sense. Let's put that in.
That's you've got it. That's exactly. And imagine someone's like, you know what, I'm going to do this, and if you want to tip into my crowdfund equity, and we actually buy this buy this thing and do the plan.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So once you get that, I think it's kind of a, it's just, I call it data liquidity. It's just making it easy to understand something that's already there. Do you know what I mean? It's easy to author. It's easy to see. People understand 3D models in a way they don't understand plans, sections, schedules. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's just, it's a way of just short-circuiting a really slow conversation. But that speed, you know, Stalin said quantity has a quality of its own. You know, speed has a quality of its own. If things happen in real time, you unlock something that you can't unlock if they don't, which is, it's interesting. It's not just that the same thing happens quicker, something different happens, which is cool.
So I promise I'm not a naysayer. A lot of the questions I feel like are coming from this angle of like, I don't get it. But what I think about is somewhat how you're describing the co-design and everyone sort of has input. In some ways, it feels a bit utopian. And what I have a hard time reconciling is in California, and I imagine this exists in other parts of the world and maybe in Australia as well, is we have this thing called NIMBY, you know, not in my NIMBYs. Backyard.
Yeah. Oh, we got them.
And, and in some ways, I think opening up a project to in such an intimate way as co-design obviously would actually sets the project up for failure. Because you get too many inputs. And so I'm trying to reconcile, you know, how do you successfully co-design in a NIMBY environment, you know, where it doesn't matter if they have input, they're going to say no to the project.
Totally. And look, and our users, and I fully endorse and respect them, utilize Giraffe in very controlled ways. You know, I'm not saying, hey, if you sign up to Giraffe, you've got to put on your tie dye and come with me and show everyone what you're doing. Right? Giraffe is an analytic tool to help you deploy capital better, and it just kicks ass at that.
Yeah.
I am seeing, and it is utopian here. I am seeing a world not only where there is risks taken by proponents of projects to be more open and engaging, because remember, this is a risk, right? Like, there's a famous case here in Australia where the developer spent, I don't know, 30 million, 40 million bucks on a scheme, hit the community, and the community just went ballistic, and they backed down. And so it's like, why don't you guys manage that risk, right? Because what Giraffe allows you to do is, because you've got all the numbers there, you can start painting benefits. You can say, look, if you give me this extra 2 stories of height, I get an extra $4 million and I will build you a swimming pool. And I can, I can connect this. So I can connect urban form to benefit. And then that opens up a conversation to say, what is important to you guys? Is what's important the height, or is it the economic impact, or is it the traffic? And so by having the thing concretely in front of you, the discussion becomes super particular. It's not like I just don't like the vibe. It's like, what don't you like? Tell me, point at it, and I'll move it. If you don't like the height there, I'll drop the height and I'll put it there. Is that, you know? And so there is a, and again, this is more like this is speculative. We've got this PhD happening. I've seen it in controlled environments. This hasn't happened in the great public arena, but definitely the quality of conversation, if you have evidence to hand and real-time feedback, it increases, and you find places to compromise on, which if you don't have this, it's hard to, because you don't know what each other are talking about. You're talking past each other. You're feeling unheard. You get angry, you get defensive, and then you. So this is designed to short circuit it. The final thing is, because Giraffe's so easy to use, anyone can just model it up. So if the developer's saying, hey, like, you can build a proforma in Giraffe in literally like 5 minutes, and so you can just model the building up and say, okay, you're building it, but tell me how many dollars per square foot hard cost and soft cost, and I'll tell you what the financials of this thing is. I don't need to see it. I can just work it out. So there's this kind of, it's like an analytical and verification tool as well. So what it does is it introduces a new level of transparency and speed into the market, into the ecosystem, which I think is positive. I think it leads to better decisions. And I think developers will appreciate, it'll be of net benefit to developers, but it will be a change. It's like a slight change in it. You can't be fully secretive without, not saying you have to be like, bare at all.
Yeah. You're spot on about kind of using it as almost a negotiation tool,
yeah.
To get to the design that ultimately is going to be economically feasible, but also acceptable to the community and the neighborhood.
And you're shaking out the particular issues. It's like, what is it, the sun you don't like? Is it the view? What is it? Yeah, yeah.
Out of curiosity, so you market to consultants, government, property developers, enterprise. Who is your number one user at this point? And how many, I think I missed it. How long have you been in business for now?
We've been, we experimented since 2017 whilst I was still an architect, and my architecture firm actually sort of seeded the business, which was awesome.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then we jumped out in 2020, so 2 years basically going. Our biggest user is, basically, I kind of say the sweet spot for Giraffe is if you're deploying, it's got to be 100 million plus for it to really sing. It makes total sense if you're just doing, like, I got an approval to subdivide my block. I used Giraffe, was the quickest and easiest. But because of these enterprise things, like you can create templates and standards and share layer packs amongst teams. So if you've got a lot of capital to deploy rigorously and in a way that, you're systemically improving your decision maker, man, the benefit just multiplies. So we go for those tier ones in government and private sector that are deploying, 100 million to 10 billion, up. The more bees, the better. The more the impact, basically.
Rob, as we wind down, for anyone that's considering this co-design approach, what are some things that you would recommend they implement or consider in approaching this kind of concept?
Okay, so I would recommend either Giraffe or something like Giraffe. So a tool which is real feedback. So that can be someone who's who can sketch really well, right? Like, a great drawer. I've seen people do it. People do it with blocks and cardboards that people can shove around. So there's this real-time feedback. The reason I say something like Giraffe is because if you can get the numbers in real time as well as the concepts, magic, right? And then I would say you need people, that facilitator, so someone who is trained not only in design and understands the issues and the technical, but is also competent to lead a conversation and facilitate. Lead from the back, recede and let other voices come through, but still orchestrate something that's it. And then the last thing I would say is just take a bit of risk, because I get it's scary, as in and you don't have to take big risks. Just do it with closed user groups. Like, You don't have to go to the public first up, but just trust, jump into the unknown and give it a go. And it's shocking. It's shockingly effective. If you've got your ears open, the amount of information that you'll receive in such a short amount of time, it's like doing weeks of research. So.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Rob. For those that want to follow along with you, if you have personal channels that you want to promote or just Giraffe, what's the best way they can follow along?
Yeah, so we're on Twitter. The best place to go to our website, and which is giraffe.build, and then follow the links.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Rob. Thank you again, Michelle, for joining me as well. Thank you to the listeners for listening. We'll talk again on the next one. Thanks. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to check out our sponsors. By checking them out and supporting them, you help us keep this show going. Thank you again to our sponsor, CTO Landscape Architecture. To learn more about how they can help you with your latest project, visit ctola.com. That's CTIOLA.com. Or you can call or text at 657-217-6169. Thank you to NCARB for their support of this podcast episode. Visit ncarb.org/AOP and contribute to the Analysis of Practice survey today. Thanks again for listening. Spaces is part of the Gable Media Network. You can check out similar content at gablemedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. If you enjoy our show, you can support us in three simple ways for free. You can leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or on your podcast app if it allows you to. Tell a friend and follow us on social media. Thanks for spending time with us. Talk soon.
Calling all AEC professionals. Get ready for unparalleled professional insights with detailed and original podcasts by RCAT. This is the podcast that brings you the untold stories and lessons learned behind the design and delivery of a building project. Hey, it's Charisse Lakeside, aka the CSI Kraken, and your host. Join me as we dive deep into the tales of conflict, triumph, and sheer ingenuity.
Yeah, so when Serena was named for the, it was going to be named for the building, you know, we really were able to work with teams at Nike Branding and how to really infuse her influence and identity in the very public spaces.
Detailed features architects, engineers, builders, and manufacturers who spill the beans on the most complex, interesting, and downright odd building conditions they've encountered.
Another challenge of the shuttle is actually in putting it in launch position is how you brace that seismically. It's really supported by only two pins at the base of the booster rockets. And there's a large base isolator that's underneath the shuttle that kind of prevents it from moving too much in an earthquake.
When you have 600 people or 300 people in a room, acoustically, you really need a high floor to floor so that you can have the right acoustic environment for people to be able to talk and that speech intelligibility is really good.
Every episode unveils lessons learned and connects you to the products you need to navigate similar challenges. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Detailed today and be prepared for the unexpected on your next project. Every building has a story, and we are here to tell it.